Welcome to Golfers on Golf Radio on AM 750 WNDZ. Golfers on Golf is presented by the five-star French Lick Resort in French Lick, Indiana.
All right. Well, it is 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. That's your call to the tee to join us for the next hour. We're going to be bringing you the world of golf from a Chicago area perspective. And hey, guys, it's only fitting. The PGA Tour this week is down in New Orleans for the Zurich Classic. It is a it's a team format, a little bit different for the PGA Tour. Kind of fun to see them two by twos. And, you know, normally as we introduce ourselves, we've got a little diversity here. We always introduce you, Rory Spears, as the longtime sports journalist. We introduce Bill Berger as the lifetime PGA member. Well, it's two on two. We've got myself, Ed Stevenson, I'm a PGA member. We got the PGA members versus two longtime sports journalists. With us today is Tim Cronin. Rory, you brought in some muscle to pair up off against the golf pros here.
Yeah, well, we decided to make it a really good even four-ball match here this morning. And it's great to have Tim with us in the studio for the first time. He's been a guest on over the phone before and from out at various tournament sites. I think he's even checked in from the Indianapolis 500 for us in the past. So we're glad to have him here in studio to talk some golf, talk a little history golf-wise. Tim's a longtime golf writer. He's written several books. At some point in the show later, maybe we'll see if he can name all of them because there's so many of them right now.
It's only an hour show.
I'm just the rank amateur here. Do I get strokes in this clubhouse?
Yeah. Tim's a guest today at our club. But anyway, Tim, longtime golf writer for the Daily Southtown. He's in charge of the Illinois Golfer these days, as well as doing work for the online publication, the Global Golf Post, CDGA Magazine, and I believe Golf Chicago Magazine as well. So he's got his hands full, and he's, if I know Tim, you're probably writing another one of your centennial books for another country club in the Chicagoland area right now.
I was working on that yesterday afternoon after I did about 14 other things. Yes, I wish I had time to play golf. I hear it's a wonderful sport.
But, you know, Mother Nature wants to give us time to play golf eventually. Here we are at the end of April here. It's a little chilly again on a Saturday morning, and I don't know, they talk about April showers bring something. I mean, what does April snow bring? I don't remember.
Baseball cancellations.
Talk about history. I don't remember an April in history like this.
Welcome
Chicago.
To Pneumonia Country Club. Well, this has been a tough month, but the sun is out. There's promise in the air of birdies and bogeys, and hopefully more birdies than anything else. And I think there will be golf this year.
The promise of a few bogeys, too, I think.
Well, Ed, you know, I got to tell you, yesterday I caught up with Len Ziem for a few minutes down in his warm, sunny estate at PGA Village in Port St. Lucie, and he said, we're getting ready to stop the mail down here, and in a week or so, we're going to start driving north and get ready for the golf season up there. I was telling him to bring his parka, but no, hopefully within 30 days or so by the time he gets up here, it should be wonderful by then.
Got to be eventually, otherwise we don't get to 95 and humid. But, you know, as we turn the corner into May, there's a pretty exciting season ahead. I know that even in the extended winter behind us, things didn't stand still. Obviously, we had the Masters, which seems to be an unofficial start to things. But here, Billy, as you and I sit with really two of the guys who cover more golf in Chicago than anybody, I've got to ask you guys, what do you think from the months as the winter finally maybe takes its last gasp here? What were some of the biggest stories for the Chicago area to come out of the winter season?
Well, I think the continuing story is the saga of Jackson Park and whether or not it and South Shore, the nine-hole course adjacent to it, will actually be revamped. The original talk was this will cost $30 million, $24 million of which was going to be raised privately, and the city and the park district are going to kick in $6 million. Then they added in the overpasses and the other extraneous necessities that you have to do when you do a big thing like this. And that gets you up to $60 million, and that's before anybody puts their thumb on the scale, and this is Chicago, so you never know what might happen. I can't imagine that this is actually going to get rolling, and let's face it, we haven't heard yet from the Chicago Parks Golf Alliance, the CPGA, which was fronted by Mark Rolfing, but is actually run by a Chicago politician or friend of politicians, at least, how much money they have raised so far of that necessary $24 million. I'd like to see that figure before I say, yeah, this thing can really happen, or no, this is going to be a boondoggle that will never get off the ground.
I was going to ask you, Tim, do you think it's got all the makings of a boondoggle?
Boondoggle Links in Jackson Park might be the name if by the time they get done with it.
You know, Tim, doing a lot of golf clinics and stuff down at Jackson Park over the years, probably Eddie's been a couple. And only because my place and time, I don't think that, you know, the few people that I know there, I don't think they're too happy with this deal because, you know, they like their area. And, you know yourself where you played at and where you like to play, you know, changing up, turning your world upside down is not a good deal for somebody.
People fall in love with their golf course.
Yeah.
I was just over at Maple Meadows, which is part of Ed's domain, the other day, and Chris Malik, their GM in the building, was talking about the old East course of Maple Meadows, the original Brookwood, saying how many people absolutely loved that golf course. And, had a go when the redo for the preserve at Oak Meadows was done. But people still remember it fondly. Imagine all the people who have played Jackson Park over the years, and South Shore for that matter, since it went public in 74, and say, boy, you know, I don't want to lose the fourth hole. I don't want to lose the seventh hole. I don't want to lose the chance to make a couple birdies, and I don't want to lose a chance to pay only $30 or $35 on a weekend, whereas when it's redone, it might be $50, and if you live outside the city, it might be in three figures.
Yeah, you know, Tim, as a golf course operator, it's interesting. That whole proposition at Jackson Park of it being affordable for the locals and maybe something that is a real revenue generator for those that are going to come to this regional attraction, boy, it sounds good. But not only thumbs on the scale in Chicago, what about zip code management and all these things? How are you going to, on a day-to-day basis, stand behind that pro shop counter and verify some of the residency issues and everything else? It's interesting, and it will be. I think you make a great point. It's going to be an interesting story to follow. And as you and I were talking about before coming on the air, here in northern Illinois, in the Chicago area, there's no shortage of projects and stories of perhaps plans that were in place and maybe going to come together. And at the end of the day, a lot of them don't. There have been many an idea for a golf course and even architectural rendering, but it's hard to ultimately get those to see the light of day.
That's exactly right. And the dollar figure is going to be the difference, I think, in this more than anything else. Some of the people in the area like it. Some of the people don't. You're going to have that mixed feeling. Some people are almost saying, well, it's going to happen. I guess we're going to be stuck with it. I don't know that there's a great deal of love for the project yet. And love is what they're going to need down there, along with the dollars and the political persuasion. Remember, we do have the Obama Library going in right nearby in Jackson Park, and that's controversial as well. So imagine trying to do two projects at the same time. Which one would be more important to the mayor of the city, who was once the chief of staff for the former president? Would it be the golf course or would it be the library? I think we know the answer to that question.
Well, it is 10:09. You're listening to Golfers on Golf Radio. I'm Rory Spears in studio today. We've got Ed Stevenson and Bill Berger, our PGA pros, along with golf writer Tim Cronin. With that, we are going to take our first break, and we'll be back with more golf talk here right after this.
When you win national awards like Golf Magazine's Renovation of the Year, Golf Digest Best New Course Renovation, and Golf Range Magazine's Top 50 Ranges, you know that you've done something right. Mistwood Golf Club, highlighted by a 67-acre rock-walled lake and St. Andrews-style sidewall bunkers. Mistwood brings a feeling of Scotland to the Midwest. Mistwood's changes include added tour length, completely redesigned third hole with an island-feeling green, new state-of-the-art performance center featuring teaching tools that the tour players use, like TrackMan, Sam Putlab, FlightScope, and Quintech Ball Roll Analysis System. Completely custom fit and built golf clubs. We can match any manufacturer's head with any manufacturer's shaft. Mistwood has the distinct honor of the highest rating for Illinois golf courses by Golf Digest, Best Places to Play. Some tee times are available, but they're filling fast, so don't delay. You can book online at mistwoodgc.com or call 815-254-3333. Mistwood Golf Club in Romeoville. Significantly renovated, completely perfected.
The newly renovated Mount Prospect Golf Club is now a Golf Week magazine top 15 best courses you can play in Illinois. Mount Prospect originally opened in the 1920s and has been restyled to look and play like the great courses of that era. If you want to play golf holes that look like they were created by the great historic designers like C.B. McDonald, Seth Raynard, or Donald Ross, Mount Prospect is for you. Mount Prospect now has an expanded practice area, a full-size double-sided driving range, and multiple putting greens. The Pro Shop has been redone and has been restocked with all the merchandise golfers need. The new golf carts are GPS touchscreen, and Mount Prospect is now the home of the half-pound Mount Prospect burger. For more information, visit us online at mppd.org or call 847-259-4200 and book your tee time at the Mount Prospect Golf Club today.
All right, it's 12 minutes after 10 a.m. here in Chicago on a Saturday morning, and Rory, we're ready for our next segment.
Yeah, we sure are, and this segment is sponsored by the French Lick Resort, the home of the Donald Ross and the Pete Dye golf courses. For more information or to book your tee times, visit FrenchLick.com.
Right here in studio this morning, I'm Ed Stevenson alongside Bill Berger, Rory Spears, and our fourth this morning, Rory, is Tim Cronin joining us and really joining you at lots of these events. You guys are part of the core that are really covering what's going on in the Chicago area. I think over the years we've talked about the great history, but there's also been an ebb and flow to the coverage of golf in the city of Chicago. And I think kind of at the core, you mentioned the great Lenzeem earlier. Len's done a great job of bringing golf to the people. We try to do a little bit of that on Saturday mornings. Yes. We did it on Sunday mornings.
Yeah, we used to.
But when it comes to ink hitting pages, Rory, you and Tim have contributed a lot.
Yeah, we sure have. Tim has written more words over the years than I have. I may have talked more words about golf than Tim has, but when it comes to writing, that's really in Tim's court and Lenny's court. Or I'll say, instead of saying court, I should probably say in their fairways, because they hit a lot of them. But you know what? One thing that we reported on yesterday on our golfersongolf.com website is perhaps the chance to see a little more golf history being made here in Chicago. And, you know, Tim started talking about golf work that could be coming on the south side. Here's something for up in the north suburbs. Golfers on Golf learned this week that the Sportsman's Country Club, operated by the Northbrook Park District, located on Dundee Road out in Northbrook, is preparing to do a major renovation of perhaps the entire property. We're not talking about just doing some greens or some bunkers or taking out a couple of trees. They're talking about moving around 27 holes. They're talking about blowing up a clubhouse, moving a practice facility, getting the driving range away from Dundee Road so if people hit the ball over the 70-foot high net, it doesn't clunk on somebody's windshield as they're driving through Northbrook. But this is a potentially really big project that if the Northbrook Park District has their way, will start in late summer of next year, 2019. The facility could be closed for about a year. And you know what? I was talking to Tim before the show. I talked to Lenzeem on the phone last night. And between the three of us, we've never heard of this format before. But the Park District requested golf course architects that would potentially do this project to come in with a partner and make a team. And the other part of your team had to be somebody who builds and designs clubhouses. So we've got a golf course architect with a clubhouse building architect teaming up to form a team. So because there's so many, as Ed Stevenson, your friend and designer at the Oak Meadows, Greg Martin, would say, there's a lot of moving parts to this project.
I heard him say that.
So instead of having a guy design a routing for a golf course, which apparently the routing there will change, and then have the clubhouse architect come in and say, hey, I was going to move the clubhouse over to where you've got the fourth hole running right now, so can you blow that up and move it around a little bit more? They want to get everybody on the same page. So we are down to six teams left for the presentations this week to the park board. And Sportsman's did some work a little over 10 years ago. And at the time, it was architect Rick Jacobson that was brought in. Golfers on Golf has learned that Jacobson did not survive the final cut and will not be part of the architectural teams that are presenting to the board this week. The teams that are presenting are listed on our website. The golf course architects are Greg Martin, Ray Hearn, Richard Mandel, who's based in Pinehurst. We have Dave Essler. We have Bob Lohman. And now I'm trying to think of that sixth name out there. Oh, Mike Benkuski, who recently did Arlington Lakes. So a lot of names that are familiar to our listeners if they've followed a lot of the course improvements and renovations in the area in recent years. The only thing I do know is one source tells us that Greg Martin has teamed up with Dan Wolfeil, who did the Mistwood Clubhouse, is going to be doing some work for Ed Stevenson, apparently, out at the Preserve at Oak Meadows. He and his team have designed the under-construction Chicago Highlands Clubhouse as well. So pretty formidable team right there. And, you know, Tim, as we talked before the show, we haven't seen this before where somebody says, hey, golf course architect, you got to bring a guy who can build a clubhouse to the table as well.
Now, that's it's an interesting concept. Ed, as you well know, is somebody who's been eagle-eyed on the Preserve at Oak Meadows project and now has the clubhouse to go to. I mean, just doing one of those things is a major undertaking and involves a lot of paperwork and hair pulling and whatnot. And now just imagine doubling it. And where's your headquarters going to be while you're building the golf course? It's not going to be in clubhouse. You're going to bring in more trailers. It just seems to me that to be an awfully large bite, though I assume that they know what they're doing and they can pull it off. But why do it that way, I wonder?
Well, I think part of it is trying to limit the downtime and disruption. If you're going to take it on, take it all on and have that period of downtime where the revenue stops happen all at once. That's one approach. And if they have the means to do it, that's great. I know at the Forest Preserve District of DuPage County, on our project, we wanted to go in and have a plan up front and ultimately be able to do it in pieces and phases. But there is no one right way to do it. What I will say is that I give them a lot of credit for pairing up the architects, both on the golf side as well as on the structural side, because you know, this idea of a master plan, when you're looking at a facility, to look at the whole facility and understand the interplay between everything is very important. We know, we were talking about the history of clubs in Chicago. There's many a private club that actually suffered a fate of boards changing, a new president, and they come in piece by piece. Hey, I never liked that tree on the third hole. I'm going to take that out. And I've always wanted a bunker here, and let's redo the green. And before you know it, you've got a hodgepodge of, you know, something that really had a collective vision at one point that has now suffered being a hodgepodge of changes and someone's fingerprint, many, many fingerprints all over it. Here you're going to bring the team in up front to put a comprehensive vision together and then hopefully be able to stay committed to that vision and executing the project.
Ed, was there any thought of ever trying to do all of this at once, or did you realize, hey, let's get the golf course done and, you know, we'll worry about the clubhouse after that?
Well, I think, you know, our philosophy going into it, the clubhouse is a very important part. I think we wanted to designate a potential site for the clubhouse, but take that afterwards. I think it's interesting to see this pairing of the clubhouse architect and golf architect, because if you talk to your golf course architect, first of all, you talk to your clubhouse architects, they'll tell you it's the heart of the property and it is going to be your revenue driver. Now, when you talk to the golf course architects, they will remind you the old cliche that nobody ever goes to the golf course to play the clubhouse. So here they are forced to hold hands and work together and should be an interesting approach. But we knew, especially as a Forest Preserve district, for us, the 288 acres that is the property, we weren't just doing a golf course. We were renovating an entire preserve, a collection of ecosystems, and the golf course being a part of it. So for us, it made sense to have that property be the dog, and the clubhouse would come not as an afterthought, but as the tail to complement the property.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're at 1020 Golfers on Golf Radio. Rory Spears, Ed Stevenson, Bill Berger, and our guest host today is Tim Cronin. And Tim, as we talked a little bit about at the top of the show, you have you kind of got your fingers in a lot of different golf projects. Tell us about some of the things you're doing with the big online publication, Global Golf Post, and along with your publication, The Illinois Golfer.
Well, Illinois Golfer is my baby. Gary Holloway was kind enough to lend me the name from his original Illinois Golfer, and that's an online monthly that usually comes out the first Monday of each month, and you can find it at www.illinoisgolfer.net. Then I also act as managing editor for Golf Chicago and write some historical pieces for Chicago District Golfer magazine, do some work for Global Golf Post as well, following equipment on the European and PGA tours, which is awfully hard to do when you're not in Europe. And for that matter, the European tour isn't in Europe this week. They're in China, so I don't know what's going on. But I do some copy editing for them, too, and a few other things for a few other people. This is what happens when you don't have a full-time job. You got to keep that mortgage payment coming.
Yeah, well, you know what? And Tim, you know, I can imagine the last week of June, the second week of July, your life gets busy because all these golf bodies didn't talk to one another, and we've got two tournaments in 1 week and three tournaments in the other all at once. So where do you go when you have all that golf at a short window?
My first thought is just to lay on the couch and watch it all on TV, but by golly, that doesn't pay. So I'll be out there for the most part. I'll be in Silvis, Illinois for the John Deere Classic, but I do want to see the start and talk to players about the concept of playing a senior U.S. Women's Open, which will just happen to be at Chicago Golf Club, which is one of the cooler places in golf on this planet. And then we also have the senior Players Championship at Exmoor, which is a wonderful club, an old Donald Ross redesign. And that one will probably get the shortest of the shrift, which is too bad because it's a great course and the players are very engaging, all those old 50-year-old guys who hit it still farther than I do, even though I'm an over 52. I guess I thought once when I looked at my game and I looked at the calendar, I thought, well, maybe I should try to qualify for the senior tour when I'm 50. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that Nick Price was turning 50 the same year. By golly, he was going to take my spot, that rascal. And he did.
Well, one of the hottest players on the senior PGA Champions Tour this year is Steve Stricker. And he had to make a decision, and apparently he's headed down to John Deere, he tells me via Twitter. So I know that some of the people up at Exmoor were looking forward to seeing him, including the chairman of the championship, who's a big Illinois backer. And one of the first things they did is he made sure they had a Steve Stricker poster up in the parking lot hanging from one of the light poles promoting that he was going to come and play Exmoor. Well, no, he's not, unfortunately. But we'll talk a little bit more about some of Tim Cronin's projects in our final segment. And a reminder that this segment was sponsored by the French Lick Resort. They have great golf. They have a casino, a spa, and the famed West Baden and French Lick hotels. Book your stay now at FrenchLick.com. We're back with Michael Trostel, the historian of the USGA, right after this.
When the wall made me slip, when the wall made me lose the cup, and never make me lose my grip.
The Arrowhead Golf Club of Wheaton, founded in 1927, has been receiving rave reviews since the architect Greg Martin renovation of all 27 holes has been completed. The course is surrounded by some of the beautiful forest preserve properties of DuPage County and has no homes in play. Water does come into play in 17 of the 27 holes, with 77 bunkers strategically located on the club's 3-9 hole layouts. The bunkers are now filled with the new white tour sand not seen on many public courses. The redone practice area has a lighted driving range, putting green, chipping green, and sand bunkers. The fully stocked pro shop is one of the best in the area, and the golf carts come complete with GPS to give the golfer exact yardage on every hole. Private and group lessons are now available, and Arrowhead has one of the best 19th or 28th holes in the area. For more information, see arrowheadgolfclub.org or call 630-653-5800.
This segment was sponsored by the Arlington Heights Park District Golf at Arlington Lakes Golf Club, Sunset Meadows Driving Range and Learning Center, and the 9-hole par 3 course at Nickel Knoll, located on Peyton's Hill. Call Nickel Knoll at 847-590-6050.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw that shot you hit.
All right, 10:25 a.m. here on WNDZ. You're listening to Golfers on Golf Radio, and I'm Ed Stevenson alongside Bill Berger, Rory Spears, our guest host in studio, Tim Cronin. And hey, guys, it's been fun to really talk golf history here in the Chicago area. You know, I think, Tim, before the show and in many other conversations, we've talked about really how rich the history here is in Chicago, even some of the undiscovered history. Or lost history, and we continue to make history. The USGA is going to be coming for what will be a new championship this July, Rory, at one of the places that really has a very interesting past here in Chicago.
Well, you can't find any more history, and I'm sure Tim would agree, in Chicago golf than at a place called Chicago Golf, the Chicago Golf Club. And they're going to be the host of the brand-new inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open this year, of course, run by the United States Golf Association. And to tell us a little bit about what's gone into planning a new U.S. Open is the senior curator and historian for the USGA, Michael Trostel. Michael, how are you this morning?
Morning, guys. How are you? Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, Michael, we also have PGA pros Ed Stevenson, Bill Berger here, and, of course, longtime golf writer Tim Cronin, who's sort of our Chicago golf historian, sitting in on the set here today. And, Michael, a new U.S. Open doesn't come along all too often for the USGA, so maybe we can start by talking a little bit about some of the planning that's gone into the event. And also, you took a very active role in having to create a new trophy. Maybe you can expand on that a little bit as well.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, it's our first Open Championship that we've created since 1980. So you're going back almost 40 years when we started the U.S. Senior Open. So this has been in the works for a while. You know, I was out at the annual meeting this year and talking with some of the players who are exempt into the championship, Pat Bradley and Jan Stevenson and Amy Alcott, and they're just so excited and inspired, I think, to try and get their games back in shape. You know, they haven't been playing that much competitively over the last few years, but they can't wait to get back into competition and try and win another national championship. And
Mike,
you know, for this trophy, yes.
Michael, how does one design a trophy? You have to work through the traditions of golf, I suppose, and not make it too outlandish, and yet it's the modern era. How do you come up with the idea, and how many ideas did you go through before you came up with the one that succeeded?
It's a good question. It probably took us about 11 months. It was almost a full year to go through the different variations and different drawings to try and get it just right. You know, and I guess there is really no right way, right, to create a trophy. You know, for our U.S. Open, we've had it since 1895. The Masters gives away a green jacket. You know, others give away cowboy boots or surfboards.
You know, we thought about that, right?
Yeah, of course. You know, we just wanted to try and create something that was an enduring symbol of the championship, something that would last for, you know, generations to come and really be a fitting tribute to the champions who win this.
Michael, you used the word enduring and you know, site selection for a new championship, as you said, the really first new championship in nearly 40 years. A place like Chicago Golf. What went into some of the considerations, and was it? I'm sure it was a difficult choice and not an obvious choice necessarily.
Well, you know, Chicago Golf being one of the five founding clubs of the USGA, and we're lucky enough to be taking the U.S. Open to Shinnecock as well this year. So two of the five founding clubs that we have is really quite a treat, and especially for me as a historian to be able to talk about this kind of stuff. That 2018 is a great year. But Chicago Golf being the oldest golf club in the U.S., you know, at the same location, you know, the connection to Charles Blair McDonald and Seth Rayner, you know, having our 12th championship there is something really special. I mean, the Chicago area has hosted, you know, so many great golf events from, you know, USGA championships, but even that's just a small part of it, you know, with the Ryder Cup and everything else that's gone into what Chicago has. So the Chicago area has had a tremendous amount of support, and Chicago Golf was really one that stuck out to us, and the club was you know, gracious enough to extend an invitation. And once that invitation came, it really wasn't that hard of a decision. We were thrilled to be able to go back there.
Well, as you know, Michael, the first time the USGA visited Chicago Golf Club was 1897. And while Lenny Z might be have been around to see Joe Lloyd win, I don't think any of us were. And the place has changed since then. Rainer came in 23 and redesigned it, and it's pretty much the same course as it was in 1923. How do you think the ladies are going to play it?
Well, it's a great question. And just, you know, first to talk about some of the history there, you know, you mentioned Joe Lloyd winning and H.J. Wiggum winning the U.S. Amateur at the same time. That was actually the last year the U.S. Open was played at 36 holes. In the last year that the U.S. Amateur and the U.S. Open were played at the same place at the same time. So, again, that's going back a long ways. You have winners like Harry Vardon and Johnny McDermott at Chicago Golf Club. McDermott, the first American winner of the championship, the youngest champion ever, even to this point. And we've been there as recently as the 2005 Walker Cup. But, you know, I think when McDonald originally designed it, I know, as you guys know, he was a little bit of a slicer off the tee. So, all the out of bounds was to the left. So that was good for him. So
that's why I play so good there.
It's changed a little bit since then, but you know, I think it'll be a great test of golf. And you know, for all of our championships, you try and create the ultimate test for the players, and that's no exception here.
Michael, what does a person in your position as a USGA historian look for during that week to perhaps keep and get to the museum at the USGA? Are you going to try to get, if somebody makes a hole-in-one, that first golf ball and put it in the USGA museum? I mean, what kind of objects? Is there anything you're going to want to try to keep for the USGA for historical purposes going forward?
You know, we actually already have an exhibit in the works for this fall for things that we're going to collect from that inaugural championship. So we're really excited about doing that. And it's tough to say exactly what it's going to be, right? I mean, certainly if there was a hole-in-one, I think we'll try and do that. You know, for the four-ball championship a few years ago, we asked for the golf ball and the driver that hit the first shot of the four-ball championship. So we may try and do something like that. Certainly we'll collect all the scorecards, tee markers, hole flags, you know, all the correspondence that goes into this. You know, it tells such a rich history. And you know, we have a couple things from the original U.S. Open Championship and U.S. Amateur in 1895. We have a medal and we have a couple photographs. But boy, do we wish we had, you know, a little bit of everything. So right now, you know, knowing what we do, I think we're going to try and collect more rather than less and preserve this history, because you know we think this championship will be around for a long, long time to come.
I know the museum half of Golf House was expanded greatly a few years ago, and you've got great displays there. But there's also a library. And I understand that's been expanded now in just the last few days. Tell our audience what makes the name Otto Probst important to you these days.
That's a great question. Yeah. So Otto Probst was a book collector. You know, his library was not just books, but periodicals, a little bit of everything that he collected in the early 20th century. And the PGA of America had this housed down in their headquarters down in Florida for a long time. But what we did in the past, I think the press release just came out within the past week, is the PGA donated. We kind of joined forces with the Probst Library now. So the USGA Library already had about 70,000 artifacts in there, whether it was books or magazines, newspaper clippings. Now to add the Probst collection is really, really special. It's kind of the one-stop shop for golf history. And if you're looking to do any sort of research on golf, now coming to the USGA Golf Museum is the place to come. So we are indebted to the PGA of America for their generous donation. And, you know, it's great. Now, you know, if you come to Far Hills, pretty much any question you have related to golf history, you'll be able to find something thanks to the collection we already have and are continuing to build upon.
I hope I can sleep in the basement when I come over there someday, Michael.
Of course.
Michael, I got to ask you, I'm looking at the picture that I took on my tour of the museum, and you had the banners hanging of the 2014, I was there in 15 or late 14, you had the banners hanging of the two U.S. Open champions between the pillars, which I understand from your director of public relations, Janine Driscoll, is kind of a tradition. Any way you add another banner up there and put the senior women's open champion and maybe the senior men's champion up there as well?
Certainly could. I mean, we've changed it around a little bit. We do like to have our men's and women's open champions up there, but you know, right now we had an exhibit at Ellis Island in the past week to highlight some of the great Scottish golfers and those who contributed to golf that came over. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because one was Donald Ross, and he's on our banner right now, who designed or at least worked on some courses in the Chicago area. Beverly, which hosted the 31 U.S. Amateur, the French we met one. Skokie Country Club, where hosted the 1922 U.S. Open, the Gene Sarazen won. So I think there's a lot of connections to Chicago golf from that exhibit. And thinking ahead, you know, being the inaugural championship, the Senior Women's Open, it wouldn't surprise me if we went that direction with the banner. So thanks for the reminder and the little push, because I think maybe that's something we could do this summer.
Well, Michael, you know, one thing that people still talk about is the 1990 U.S. Open here at Medina, where Hale Irwin got in on a special exemption. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe he's still the oldest person to win the men's U.S. Open and anywhere, and it was done right here in Chicago, correctly?
Absolutely right, and I think what's cool about Chicago is you guys have the youngest U.S. Open champion, Johnny McDermott, 19 years old from 1911, and then the oldest from Hale Irwin. You know, and as you said, he had to get a special exemption to come in. He had won the U.S. Open in 1974 and 1979. You win the U.S. Open, you get a 10-year exemption, so 1990 was the first year he wasn't exempt to play. Abba was playing really well and got an exemption to come in there at Medina. I had kind of a slow first round, but then put himself in position on the last day. I shot a 67 and drained about a 50-foot putt on that 72nd hole, and was so enthusiastic. And, you know, Hale was normally a very quiet, stoic guy, kept his emotions in check, but just a burst of enthusiasm. And he took a lap, high-fived everybody, and then went on, and it very well could not have won the next day. He was down two strokes in the 18-hole playoff to Mike Donald, but Hale birdied the 16th hole, Mike Donald bogeyed 18, and then the first playoff hole, sudden-death playoff hole, Hale won. So a very historic championship to be the oldest to win in a special exemption, the only one to do that, and right there in the Chicago area at Medina is pretty special.
And the first one in sudden death. And on the fifth hole of that playoff, I remember he was in the right rough and he hit a three wood about 7 yards. So that might be the shortest three wood in U.S. Open history.
That could be, yeah.
Michael, put that down. Let's get that in the museum right now.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm going to ask Hale for that three wood.
No.
It's in pieces if you get it.
Hey, Michael, when I was there, you people were just starting to build the, I'm going to call it the Jack Nicklaus wing. Can you tell us a little bit about the museum? I know more people at the USGA, probably besides yourself, would love to see more golfers as they come to the New York area sort of put that on their bucket list as a place they should come visit. It's a great place if you love golf to see golf history.
It's a great place. And if you're passing through New York, Philadelphia, if you're flying into Newark Airport, it's only about an hour away and well worth the visit. I mean, artifacts going back, well into the 1800s, we have the Moon Club that was used by Alan Shepard in the surface of the moon. For the golf enthusiasts, about Bob Jones winning the Grand Slam. We have dozens of artifacts from him. Ben Hogan's one iron he used in 1950, and still collecting things from the present day. Michelle Wee won the 2014 Women's Open, things from Tiger Woods and Rory and Jordan Spieth from his win in 2015. But as you mentioned, the Jack Nicklaus room, we opened that in 2015 and have just under 100 artifacts from Jack's career, which is so special. Having just to even pick out one of them, we're just talking about a three-wood. The three-wood he used was the same one his entire career. All 18 professional majors, including his two U.S. amateurs, wow, that he used the same three-wood for, is just remarkable. He used it for more than a quarter century. You just don't see that today. So, to have Jack, golf's greatest major champion, now featured. We already had rooms with Ben Hogan and Bob Jones, Mickey Wright and Arnold Palmer, but to add a Jack Nicklaus wing has been, a great experience for us and I think for the visitors too. So well worth the experience to come in.
Well, Michael, one other thing that I did want to ask you about, the release just came out in the last week or so about ticket availability for the U.S. Senior Women's Open coming up July 12th through 15th at the Chicago Golf Club. I know tickets are on sale now. Can you tell us anything about the tickets? The one thing that I know a lot of golf people who go to USGA championships where there are tickets is they just love to keep those tickets as part of their memorabilia collection. And is there anything that went into the design of the tickets, picture of the trophy, photos of golf history at Chicago Golf that's going to be on those tickets that people are going to want to buy?
Yeah, I believe the trophy is on the ticket, so it'll be, trying to think about would put on there, you know, designing tickets for the U.S. Open and Women's Open. There's a lot of history, so you can go back to, you know, at the U.S. Open this year, players that have won at Shinnecock before. But for this, it's brand new, so we wanted to put the trophy on there. And, you know, as you mentioned, tickets available at usseniorwomensopen.com. And what I love about the offering in this one is that fans can have the unique opportunity to walk inside the ropes. So spectators can walk right along the fairways, you know, keeping a respectful distance from the players. But, you know, it's really a one-of-a-kind, very intimate experience for all the fans, similar to what they would have experienced for those that made it out to Olympia Fields a couple of years ago when Bryson DeChambeau won the U.S. Amateur. So, you know, the U.S. Open is great. It's a great spectacle. But there are, you know, 30, 40,000 people out there, and you do have to worry about the ropes. With the Senior Women's Open in Chicago this year, I think the best part is you'll be able to get right up to the players, hear those conversations between caddies and players. And I think it'll be a great take and you know, hopefully get some great weather there in July.
That's marvelous. What a concept. I love it. Sounds like the old school at the old school course.
Exactly right.
Michael, you got an early favorite. We're going to put you on the spot here. Is anybody jumping out at you as somebody who could get around and take home that trophy for a little while or their replica thereof?
Yeah, I, you know, when you think of all the players in the field, and it's going to be a great one. There's going to be kind of a who's who of women's golf and senior women's golf. Julie Eakster has been playing so well. You know, she's obviously a three-time or two-time U.S. Women's Open champion, but, you know, still competing at a very high level on the LPGA Tour, just played in her last Women's Open championship a couple of years ago, still making cuts out there with, you know, girls that could be, you know, her even younger than her daughters are. So I think if I had to say an early favorite, I think, you know, Julie is someone to keep an eye on who's been playing great golf and could, you know, potentially distance herself from the rest of the field.
All right. Well, Michael Troster, senior curator, historian of the USGA Museum and a historian for the USGA. Thanks for jumping in here. We'll look forward to seeing you in July out at the historic Chicago Golf Club for the inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open. Tickets on sale now, usseniorwomensopen.com. And Michael, again, we'll look forward to seeing you this summer. Thanks for jumping in and shedding a little light on the brand new U.S. Open.
Thanks, guys. It's been a treat.
Thank you.
All right. That was Michael Trostel from the USGA. And with that, we are going to take our final break, and we'll be back for our final segment right after this.
I use a four wood. I just can't drive. Can't really swing hard. I got a bad back.
This segment was sponsored by the Arlington Heights Park District Golf at Arlington Lakes Golf Club, Sunset Meadows Driving Range and Learning Center, and the 9-hole par 3 course at Nickel Knoll, located on Peyton's Hill. Call Nickel Knoll at 847-590-6050.
The French Lick Resort is one of America's top destination properties, featuring the highest rated golf courses and also rankings and ratings from national golf publications. The resort is complete with the Pete Dye and Donald Ross golf courses and the 9-hole Valley Links golf course and redone practice areas. Need more about the resort's overall operations and what they offer? Well, try checking out the spa, the casino, and guests have two great hotels to pick from, including the French Lick Hotel or the dome-shaped West Baden Hotel that has been one of the wonders of the world for a long time. The French Lick Resort has been home to several major golf championships and has hosted spring training for the 1908 world champion Chicago Cubs. So why not come to Southern Indiana and enjoy all French Lick has to offer? For details, visit FrenchLick.com. In addition, the tee is now open. Up in Wisconsin at Erin Hills, home of the 2017 U.S. Open, the pros and the top amateurs are gone, and now the course is all yours. And this year, there are several new ways to enjoy Erin Hills. Right now, they have created the Kettle Loop. That's right. There's a 5-hole layout that you can play if you arrive late in the day and want to get a few holes of golf in before you spend the night in either one of their overnight rooms or their cottages. You can enjoy activities, including the ping pong table that is up in the Caddy Barn. And also right now, the Koepka Challenge. That's right, Brooks Koepka, the U.S. Open. They have created a Koepka Challenge. For more information on exactly what that is, learn more at aaronhills.com. Repeat, aaronhills.com. Opening for the season, just days away.
All right, we're back. You're listening to Golfers on Golf Radio. And Rory, your read there during the break for French Lick and for Erin Hills, that sounded like my summer travel wish list. Two great destinations, both both are certainly within within driving distance. And let's put it on the calendar. Let's make sure we hit the road and get to some of these places. Rory,
well, we heard from Brendan Sweeney of the French Lick Resort a couple of weeks ago on our opening show to find out what was going on down there. And of course, broke a little news with the addition that nine more holes are going to go up to make that third course, the nine-hole Valley Links course, which is an old Tom Bendelow design, 18 holes. And we've got Tim Liddy, a kind of a Pete Dye disciple, along with Brad Klein, coming in to walk the property now any day and present a master plan to the resort on how to expand that golf course. And Erin Hills getting ready to open in early May, and we'll have Erin Hills Ambassador Rich Tock join us to fill us in on the Kettle Loop, the Koepka Challenge, the Caddy Barn activities, all sorts of new little things to check out now that the pros and the top-rated amateurs have left Erin, Wisconsin, and are headed to the Northeast in the U.S. Open of Shinnecock Hills in mid-June. Coming up, it'll be here before we know it.
Well, guys, we've certainly rounded the turn in our hour of golf talk. We're, in fact, heading into the final stretch of holes here, and want to close with maybe a couple birdies to make up for any bogeys that happen. I think it's been great so far. Enjoyed speaking with Michael Trostel during the first part of the show, joining myself, Ed Stevenson, with Bill Berger, Rory Spears, and Tim Cronin, and Michael being the USGA senior curator and historian. Obviously, an interesting guy. He gets to share the history of golf with people every day. And Tim, really, you do so as well. And I'm a little biased as I sit here thinking about, really what Michael gets to do, what you get to do in the sport of golf. Every sport loves its history. Baseball fans love their history. But I think golf fans are, a notch more engaged. And maybe that's just my perception, but when you talk to people about the history of this sport, is golf got a little extra special love affair with its past?
Well, I think it's because we see these guys play not just for 3.5 or 4 or 5 years, like your average NFL or NBA career, but we see these guys play for 50 years. Arnold Palmer was playing golf when I was born, and he was playing golf almost until he died a few years ago. That's a long time to get to know somebody and to get to love what they do and for them to love back. And Arnold was certainly, you know, the foremost proponent of that. Everybody loved Arnold Palmer and that army. Let me put it this way. I covered the Masters in 1993, which was the year that Bernhard Langer won his second green jacket. And some people down there said, oh, this is the most boring Masters that ever happened. And I remember two things vividly about it, aside from the fact that Langer won. One is that Chip Beck didn't go for it on 15 on Sunday when he had a chance to go for the lead. And he later said it was a bad back. But at the time, people were wondering, why didn't you go for it? You got to go for it now. This might be your one and only chance. And it was, in fact, his own one and only chance to win the Masters. And the other thing I remember is going out to watch the ceremonial tee shots of Sarazen and Nelson and Snead on Thursday morning, the only time I saw Nelson swing a club, which was great fun. And then coming back out after breakfast to watch some early golf. I was walking to the sixth hole, and I heard this roar go up. Turns out that I thought, oh, that must be Arnold. He must have made a birdie. Sure enough, he did. He had birdied the third hole. He had also birdied the first and second holes, and he was leading the Masters at age 63, I think it was. Arnold Palmer leading the Masters. Well, I didn't get to the sixth green. I walked over to the fourth tee. You can't run at Augusta National, but you can walk very fast if you know where you're going. And I was able to be able to say, I saw Arnold Palmer lead the Masters in person. And that's the kind of thing that I think people love about this game and why that connection lasts and it goes on forever.
Well, you know, Michael talked about the chance for the fans to be inside the ropes coming up here at Chicago Golf for the U.S. Senior Women's Open. I think another piece of that, and that's a great point, Tim, I think another piece of that connection is that these courses, these venues, many of them anyways, where the game is played, particularly when they're at a public course, we get a chance as golfers to go and play these same venues. Now, I'll never get to go, if I'm a baseball fan, I can't go pitch to Babe Ruth. I'm never going to get to play against Michael Jordan one-on-one on a basketball court. But, you know, you talk about roars. I remember being at the TPC Scottsdale when Tiger made his hole-in-one, and the place went absolutely nuts. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I played the same golf hole. I didn't make the hole-in-one, but I had a chance to. And you know, you get that opportunity in golf. You know, Payne Stewart, a major championship winner at Kemper Lakes, which was part of the public golf portfolio here in Chicago for so long. How many people got to play that same finishing stretch of 16, 17, and 18? And I don't know what other sport you get to do that in.
It's one of the things that made Cog Hill and the Western Open so symbiotically popular
right.
with each other is, A, you could play the course before or after, and then you could compare yourself against what a Nick Price or a Russ Cochran, the first winner there, or a Tiger Woods did. It was great fun.
Or somebody who might have stubbed his toe coming in.
I can't imagine who you're speaking of there, Mr. Norman. No.
You know, but, Tim, you mentioned turning 50 that you gave a brief thought of senior tour. Well, myself chasing both the regular and the senior tour, I always get questions from people. Bill, you think I could, qualify for a tournament? And I always was amazed that the interest that, you know, Ed talks about playing a hole for people, and then you got that level of people, the guy's a club champ or whatever, and he has no idea how stiff the competition is, but he dreams that, you know, but he just doesn't have the wherewithal to make the move and try it, but it's always on the mind, And I'll give you credit that it even crossed your mind. That's pretty good, you know.
Well, it didn't cross very far. But golf is the ultimate Walter Mitty game because you can, you know, make that great second shot into the, say, you know, just to pull one out of my hat, the sixth hole at Point of Woods and set up a 20-footer for birdie and make the birdie. Why they haven't put the plaque in the fairway, I don't know, but they haven't. But the same thing can happen to anybody.
Right.
The trick is consistency in golf is the hardest thing to do, I think, in any sport. Hit that ball in the right place at the right time, judge the wind, judge the roll of the green, judge yourself against the other competitors, and keep doing it for 72 holes. Good luck with that.
Yeah, 2019, again, the Western Amateur going back to Point of Woods, the course that Tim just mentioned. And you know what? I got to admit, Tim, I don't know that we played the same tee box because there's been a couple of them added, but the first time I played Marion, to walk almost over the Hogan plaque in the 18th fairway and have my ball 15 to 20 yards in front of it to hit my second shot into that historical green was pretty special. Tim,
Hogan didn't have metal woods.
No, he probably didn't. He probably didn't have a graphite shaft.
What kind of golf ball was he playing? Okay.
Not the Titleist Pro V1 at the time. But, Tim, one thing that you've done is you've kind of expanded Tim Cronin Golf as you've taken on the project of writing some of these historical books for some of Chicago's famous clubs. Tell people about what you do and some of those projects and what they've been like for you to work on that.
Well, when I'm lucky enough to get a phone call from a nice club, I start, and they agree to what we're considering here. I start researching their history, talk to everybody I can over there, look through everything they have, go through newspaper microfilm, which happily these days you can do online. You don't have to sit in the library for hours and hours and doze off as the reels go by. And you can search it too, which is even better. And then try and make something interesting on paper and take a bunch of photos and put it together. And so far, so good. I've done but seven of them or so, and nobody's said no yet. Uh-huh. So far, it was seven birdies, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I believe you've got more in the works, potentially, coming down the pipe for a few clubs.
I'm working on one right now for a notable club in the Western Suburbs. I don't know if we want to announce it yet, mm-hmm. but hopefully that'll work well. And then there might be a couple others down the line if I twist some arms and actually try and market myself. I've been very fortunate in that people have called me rather than me having to go out and beg. Mm-hmm. And thank heavens for that, or otherwise I'd be sitting here with a barrel around my
Well, we've mentioned the WGA and the Western Open a couple of times, and you did a book for the Western Golf Association.
That's where it started in golf. I had done a quickie book on Northwestern's Rose Bowl season, and they were looking for an author at the WGA after their first author turned in something that wasn't very good. And happily, after I outlined the book on the phone, they said yes, and away we went for that. I don't know how many books have been outlined on the phone before that have sealed the deal, but I fooled them, and by golly, they loved it. And A Century of Golf, you can still find it in secondhand bookstores or on eBay for $5 or $6, and it's worth every penny.
Well, then did you know Al Barkow?
I know of, and Al and I have spoken a couple times, but okay. I've never actually sat down and chatted with him. If I did, we might be closing the bar.
You know, he reminds me a lot of you. I did. My good friend grew up with him, and he played a lot of golf. He was really a good player, and he wrote the book the Golf's Greatest Grind or whatever.
Golf's Golden Grind and the History of the PGA Tour, both of them, yeah. We steal from those books all the time. Those are excellently done.
Yeah, he really hits the nail on the head a lot of times in sayings. He always had the off-color sayings, not real bad, but he was a true character in sayings. So I thought maybe, I forget when he passed away, I don't remember.
I don't know if he has. I hope he hasn't. Yeah, I hope he's still around.
I don't know if he has.
I'll look in the Golf Writers Directory and give him a call, and if he answers, that'll be good news.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Tim, what's it like for a guy like you when you find yourself being able to wander around, the library or the historic room or the place where the artifacts are stored at a place like Chicago Golf where they're going to have the Senior Women's Open this summer?
Well, I haven't done a book for them, but for like Medina or Olympia Fields or Beverly, it's a treat. I've managed to do all three of those, and that's kind of in many ways the holy trinity of Western Open golf in Chicago, because so many Westerns, if you count them up, have been held at those three clubs together. And I was a big Billy Casper fan growing up, along with Palmer and Nicklaus, and Casper won three of his four Western Opens at Medina and he actually won two at Midlothian, so I haven't done that. I've confused myself for a change. It's been a lot of fun, and it's nifty to be able to see the firsthand trophy or whatnot to really get a knowledge of what's going on here, and that people have cared so much about this game over the years. That's the amazing thing. You know, there's a great renewal of interest in history of things like that at clubs that have come up with their centennial. Sometimes they paid no attention until right before, but now they're really gung-ho for it.
You know, Timmy, you look like you're a pretty middle of the road guy, and you could. What's your comment on the rivalry of the Western and USGA? That has never ceased from the 1890s.
It was huge in the old days.
I just got the biggest kick out of it. Michael, he is really good at his job, but that always amazes me. Whenever I was old enough to understand, I'm from Northeastern Ohio, so Western Open was way more to us than the U.S. Open because of Midwestern. Western Open was held at Youngstown Country Club in 1921. So as a kid and a golf nut, it always amazed me when I got to Chicago, I always got a kick out of the rivalry of the Western Open trying to survive the number one USGA.
They have so far. Now it's the BMW, but for a long time, the Western Open was a major championship, and now people say it isn't. And, of course, the question is, well, when did it stop being one? And I think it was because of TV and things like that. But, yeah, there's always been a rivalry between those two.
Well, guys, time flies when you're having fun. Want to issue a special thanks to our guest host, Tim Cronin. Of course, you can find more of him through many outlets, but make sure you check out IllinoisGolfer.net. We're looking forward to the May issue, which will be right around the corner. Of course, archive there all the great content covered in the past months and years. Of course, you can catch us between the broadcasts. Our very own Rory Spears does the Golfers on Golf blog. It's at golfersongolf.com. And we will be back on the air next Saturday at 10 a.m.
with our special guest host, the director of golf, Andy Michelson from Misswood Golf Club.
Okay, until then, we thank you for tuning in. For Bill Berger, Tim Cronin, Rory Spears, I'm Ed Stevenson. Hit 'em straight.
Bye-bye.
You better love the one you with. Love the one you with. Love the one you with.
love the one you're with. Golf is silly, but it's sad. If you ever make contact, you should be